Whoever you are, we welcome you. Whoever you love, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Ours is a church. Oh, I need to introduce myself. Good morning. My name is Max Grubb, and I'm serving as your worship associate. And ours is a church that strives to practice the fragile art of hospitality. And in the spirit of that, we ask that you take a few moments to greet your neighbor. And I know we're sort of honoring someone as they leave today. Does anyone remember the name?
Pat
Pannell. Pat Pannell? Yes. So please join us for that. Thank you, Kristen. We come together this morning to remind one another to rest for a moment on the forming edges of our lives, to resist the headlong tumble into the next moment, until we claim for ourselves awareness and gratitude. Taking the time to look into one another's faces and see their communion, the reflection of our own eyes. The house of laughter and silence, memory and hope, is hallowed by our presence together.
For our opening words this morning, I have a poem titled, "I Don't Like My Boomerang," by Les Barker. This was recorded on his album, Up a Creek Without a Poodle. I don't like my boomerang. I know what you're going to say. If you hate your boomerang so much, why don't you throw it away? Well, that's all very well in theory. It may seem that simple to you. Why don't you throw your boomerang away? 'Cause I threw it away yesterday, too. Sometimes, when I'm in the front garden, I throw it and then hurry indoors. And with a half hour, there's a ring on the bell, and a little boy says, "Is this yours?" Once I got really angry. I taped some dynamite to it, and without really thinking things through, I lit the fuse and I threw it. With hindsight, this was an error. I had a Jack Russell Terrier once. I used to call him Jack. I used to throw my boomerang for him. The stick used to bring the dog back. I've seen the boomerang advertisements in store windows. It gets me right here like a knife. A boomerang's not just for Christmas. A boomerang is for life. You know, many of our personal problems come from our interactions with other people. And try as we might to throw our troubles away, they keep coming back like an unwanted boomerang, forcing us to face our issues like it or not. Our seven principles, which Unitarian Universalist congregations promote, include wording affirming the inherent worth and dignity of every person, and they call for compassion in human relations, along with acceptance of one another. Where does one begin to understand the complexities of human nature in order to extend empathy and compassion to another person? We'll explore that issue today as we investigate why the best solution to our problems may not be to put your troubles on the bus. I was pretty little, probably around 4 years old when the incident occurred. My face was pressed up against the glass window on the public bus, looking out at the road that led up to the hill, to my home. It wouldn't be my home anymore, not after what had happened. I was sitting on the bus by myself, wondering what my new life would be like, wondering if my new family would love me and wouldn't think that I smelled bad. Then the bus door made that releasing hydraulic sound, swoosh, as the opposite sides of the same door came together and the bus lunged slowly forward. And with the bus in motion, I saw my 7-year-old sister, Kathy, standing on the sidewalk. And just as her image was about to leave the picture frame of the window, now in sliding motion, I saw her raise her right hand and with fingers stretching up and down, she waved goodbye with just a hint of a smile at the end of her lips. And then she was gone, and I was going, but I didn't know where. How did I get myself into this situation? When I was little, we lived on top of Chestnut Hill, overlooking the small, steel-producing town of Butler, Pennsylvania. In what I thought was a happy family, there was my father, who worked a lot at the iron mill, and my mother, who took care of me all day long, and my older sister, Kathy, along with a brand new baby sister named Jean. I had a dog named Maggie, and Maggie's puppies died, so she adopted a wild baby bunny that she got in the woods to raise. And I had a duck that my grandfather had given me for Easter. And we had this big backyard, and it was surrounded by woods with a lot of nearby neighbor kids to play. It was the 1950s, so kids just played outside in the summer, and nobody ever thought anything could go wrong. My father took me fishing a lot, so he seemed friendly enough. My mother had her hands full with three little kids, but she always fed me, so she seemed nice. That's when it came to me as a bit of a surprise the day my sister Kathy said, "You know, Mommy and Daddy don't like you." "What do you mean they don't like me?" I asked. "They like me." "No, they don't," she answered. "I heard them talking, and they said they don't like you. Nobody likes you." My sister had never been particularly friendly towards me. There was the time we were playing hide and seek, and she locked me in the shed beneath the back porch, and she never responded to the Ollie Ollie Oxenfree. My dad found me caged there an hour later when dinner was on the table. "How'd you lock yourself into this shed?" he asked. Somehow, my explanation of sabotage by my sister didn't satisfy his question. "Don't do that again," he ordered. I should have known right then and there that she was out to get me. "Yuh-uh," she said. "Nobody likes you. Mommy and Daddy said they're going to give you away to a new family." "Why would they want to do that?" I wondered aloud. "It's because you're adopted," she said sadly. "Adopted? What's that?" "It means nobody wants you," she said with certainty. Funny thing was that for the rest of my life, I kept asking if I really had been adopted. And one time when I was a teen and naturally felt like I didn't belong in this tribe of lunatics, I asked again, and I was told, "Look, if you had been adopted, we would have picked a kid who can clean his bedroom better." As an adult, I would sit with my father in the hospital waiting for his turn at open heart surgery, quadruple bypass. I saw the fear in his eyes, even though he was trying to put on a brave face, and not wanting to accept my potential genetic fate and trying to lighten the moment, I whispered to him, "You know, I won't be upset if right now you tell me I really had been adopted." "Nope," he answered with a weak smile. "Sorry to disappoint you. You're one of mine." He closed his eyes and he added, "You better lay off the ice cream and chips." But at that time, I didn't know what adopted meant. It just sounded very bad when Kathy said it. "Even if I was adopted," I pleaded, "everybody likes me." "I don't," she said. "And why not?" I demanded to know. "It's because," and then she paused and said, "it's because you stink." Now, this news gave me something to consider. It's bad enough learning that I had been adopted, but now I smelled bad too. I started to cry, sobbing actually. "You don't have to cry," she said, probably not wanting to attract unwanted parental attention to our front yard conversation. "There's a nice family that wants to adopt you back." I stopped sobbing. This seemed like a positive turn of events. "Why would they want me?" I asked, wiping my eyes with the back of my hand. "Well," she said, searching for an answer, "it's because they stink too." You know, somehow that answer didn't bother me. I guess when you're in a pinch, you take what you can get. And they live far away, and they want a little boy just like you to come and live with them. And they want you to come to them right now. How would I get there? Well, Kathy had an answer for everything. You get there on the bus, she said with an emphatic nod of her head. The bus. Okay, now, I was familiar with the bus. My mother took me on the bus to go shopping, and I liked the bus. The bus driver was friendly. I told him about my turtles, Mert and Gert, and I'd like to talk to all the old ladies, and I'd sing songs. I wasn't afraid of the bus. Well, she said, it's time for you to get on the bus. Right now? Yep, right now. No suitcase, no pets, no stuffed animals in tow, just me. And at the end of the ride, there'd be this nice family who wanted to adopt a smelly little kid like me. Kathy took me by the hand, and we walked down to the bottom of the hill, and we didn't have to wait long. The bus pulled up at the corner of Chestnut and Fulton, and I got on the bus. Now, I guess you'd wonder why nobody noticed a little kid getting on the bus by himself. It was busy with travelers getting on and off, and I probably looked like I belonged to one of the women on the bus, and kids rode for free. That's how, at 4 years old, I came to be on the bus by myself, looking out the window, face and palms pressed up against the glass, as my sister waved goodbye and disappeared from view. And I sat forward, wondering what my new life would be like. At this point, I will agree with you. I was not a bright child. Now, what I didn't know was that as the bus was pulling away from the curb, my mother, with baby Jean in her arms, was walking down Chestnut Hill looking for her wayward children who were supposed to have been playing in the yard. Where's Tom? She asked Kathy. Kathy hesitated as she watched the bus pull away. It's not my fault, she said. Tom got on the bus. What? My mother demanded. Why did he do that? I don't know, Kathy answered. I tried to stop him, but he wouldn't listen. There were no cell phones during those days, and my father had our only car at work. There my mother stood, with the baby in one arm, a little girl holding on with the other hand, watching the bus pull away, drive down the street with her second child aboard. Fortunately, the bus was driving to the end of the street, which was a cul-de-sac, where it turned around and then it headed back in the opposite direction and it had a downtown destination. My mother stood in the middle of the street to flag down the lumbering vehicle. The bus driver stopped, even though it wasn't on his route to do so. Is there a little boy on this bus? She asked the bus driver when the doors opened. Everybody turned and looked at me sitting in the middle of the back bench seat. Is that him, lady? The bus driver asked as he looked back in the rearview mirror. Tom, get off this bus right now, she insisted. I remember the tap on the back of my head when my feet hit the sidewalk as I disembarked, and she said, you're in big trouble, mister. I remember being dragged up the hill with my mother's hand tightly clenching mine, and she was reading me the riot act. Statements like, I can't believe you would do something like this, and you nearly scared me to death, kept coming out of her mouth. Baby Jean was crying. I tried to explain what happened, but she wouldn't listen. You're going straight to your room, young man, and don't you ever pull a trick like that again. Now that's how I remember the bus incident. As an adult, I asked my mother if she remembered my bus adventure. I had three little kids to keep track of, she said, and you ran all over the neighborhood. But then she added, but I seem to recall a time that you got on the bus by yourself. Kathy put me on that bus, I reported. No, I don't think so, she replied with a laugh. Why would she want to do that? I think you just wanted to go for a ride. And then she paused and shook her head and said, Tom, it was so long ago. I just don't remember. But I do. I remember being lectured as we walked up the hill to our home at 634 Chestnut Street. I remember that I couldn't get a word in edgewise to explain my side of the story. And I remember looking back at Kathy while I was being dragged up the hill. She was right behind me, and she had this look on her face. Her lips were pinched together, her nose was flared out, her eyes were narrow and staring. Her head was tilted to one side. Her gaze was fixed directly on me. Her diabolical plan had failed. I realized right then and there, at that very moment, that from now on, I'd have to watch my back. Why are other people so stupid? I know you've asked yourself this question, and probably more than one time. Of significance are the words "other people." Rarely do we position ourselves as the inept individual who is the subject of the question. We place the negative connotation on the other person. Our seven principles of Unitarian Universalism include language addressing the inherent worth and dignity of every person, compassion in human relations, and acceptance of one another. I try to be a caring person, but I find it difficult to understand why other people behave the way they do. I become frustrated and judgmental, and then I'm right back to asking, why are other people so stupid? It took me some time to come to an understanding of why I don't always get other people. And this concept became clear to me when an old man muttered four simple words during an incident at a red light. I was having my car tires changed at a shop in East Akron. It was a nice day, so I was sitting outside on a bench facing Canton Road, and I was reading a book. An older man was seated next to me. He was enjoying the sunshine on this early spring morning. And just then, the calm was shattered when a large pickup truck stopped at the red light just in front of us. The driver was probably no older than 17, and he was revving the engine. He had oversized speakers mounted in the bed of the open truck, and it was blasting music, and that music could be heard for blocks away. The music included lyrics that shouted every swear word imaginable, over and over again. It was a really long red light. The old man and I looked at the truck, and then we followed it with our eyes as it sped away at the green signal. It was still blaring the curse words as it headed south. The old man just lowered his head and began to shake it from side to side. I looked at him and I said, "You know what's funny about this? In that kid's world, right now, that behavior makes perfect sense." And without looking up, the old man replied, "That's not my world. That's not my world." Here's what those four words help me to understand. We all coexist on this same planet together, but every one of us lives in a different world. We all coexist on this planet together. But every one of us lives in a different world. Where do respect, compassion, acceptance of others begin? It begins when I recognize that all the people surrounding me live in their own personalized worlds, and those worlds aren't necessarily my world. To really understand another person's point of view, we need to make an effort to relate to the realities of his or her world. And the difficulty of that is this. Try as we might, we can never completely comprehend the totality of another person's existence, even for those that we are closest to. Beloit College in Wisconsin publishes the yearly College Mindset, detailing some of the experiences that are common to the entering class of freshmen. It describes the world within which these teens were raised during the past 20 years, and then it unavoidably contrasts in our minds those realities that preceded their birth so as to highlight the difference in their worldviews when compared with that of an older person. In the worlds of my college students who will enter the University of Akron this fall, email is too slow. Many of them have never written, addressed, or mailed a letter by U.S. snail mail. Phones in their lives have never had cords. Most do not know how to write in cursive. Russia and America have always been friends, and what's the big deal about some wall in Berlin? In their worlds, they have never rolled down a car window. Fox has always been a major TV network. IBM never made typewriters. And they get more information from Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert than from a newspaper. In their worlds, GPS satellite navigation systems have always directed their travels. There have always been charter schools, gay rabbis, Episcopal female priests, nutritional labeling, women's study majors in college, condoms advertised on television, and in their worlds, McDonald's has always been serving Happy Meals in China. That's not my world. The realities of our individual worlds are shaped by our personal experiences and directed by our perception of those experiences. My daughter-in-law, Megan, teaches second grade in an inner-city public school in Akron. It's a rough area. One of the lessons she taught was about understanding your feelings. And as an assignment, the children were asked to write about something that made them feel sad. Now, in the worlds of your childhood and my childhood, we might have written about how our cat ran away and that made us feel sad. One little boy wrote about how his father had shot and killed a man and how it made this little boy feel sad when his father went away to jail. Events beyond our control influence the content of our worlds, and individuals perceive similar events differently depending on the effect that these events have on their worlds. Consider the contradiction in the perception of reality between the Israelis and the Palestinians. These two peoples occupy the same land and have experienced the same historical events. The Israelis declared independence in 1948, and they perceived the establishment of the nation of Israel as an historic victory for Jewish national identity. The Palestinians refer to the same event as the Nakba, and that's translated into English as the catastrophe. Two peoples existing side by side in the same space and time, and each perceives the same event with opposite interpretation. So I return to my original explanation of how such a contradiction of reality can exist simultaneously. We all coexist on this same planet, but every one of us lives in a different world. Now that all seems straightforward enough, but the complication is this. At exactly the point when we believe we understand the perception of another, then everything changes. There is a fluidity to life that makes existence interesting and comprehension of others challenging. Heraclides was a Greek philosopher in Asia Minor around 500 before the Common Era. He expressed a doctrine of change, stating that change is central to the universe. If there's one thing we can count on, Heraclides said, it's that everything will change. He's credited with saying, ever newer waters flow on those who step into the same river. And in modern language, we'd say, you cannot step into the same river twice. One person's experience compared to another person's experience can never be exactly the same thing. Just as a riverbed follows the same channel, but the water within it constantly changes, the same is true for the fluidity of our lives. Fluidity exists even in conditions that appear to be intractable. Some interesting research has recently addressed the question of why children who are raised in the same family can turn out to be so different. If they are raised in the same house with the same parents, how is it that each child grows to become very different as an adult? In other words, if they were raised in exactly the same world, how is it that their individual worlds turn out to be so different? And research suggests that the flaw in this common logic is for us to believe that they were all raised in exactly the same world. A separation of several years' difference between the oldest and the youngest child would include the realities of aging parents, changes in social customs, perhaps advancing technological developments. Even if these differences are perceived to be slight, research says they are still significant to the development of our individual worldviews. My sister Kathy and I are very good friends. We've shared a lot of our joys and sorrows over the years. And when I mentioned the bus incident, she claims that most likely I put myself on the bus, and that if she was even present at all, it was probably to try to get me off the bus. The conversation between us about the bus incident goes like this. Did you or did you not tell me I was adopted when we were little? Yes, that's what I said, she'll answer. And didn't you say I was smelly? I just calls them as I smells them. You put me on that bus, I demand. That's ridiculous, she'll respond. What possible motivation could I have had to want to put you on the bus? You know, in hindsight, I have a deeper understanding from my worldview of the dynamics of that situation that might direct a little girl to try to protect her world as it existed in the mid-1950s. Kathy was 3 years older than me. Between Kathy and me, there were two other siblings who had died, twin girls who didn't survive. My parents were grief-stricken. It's probably a natural reaction to turn renewed attention to the surviving child, my sister Kathy. And then another child came along, me. This new son demanded attention, and the dynamics of the family relationship changed. I can imagine my sister standing next to our mother as she held me rocking, and Kathy saying, take him back to the hospital, Mommy. We don't want him anymore. Looking into her uncomfortable little world, I can imagine that in her mind, when all else failed to return her world to its preordained bliss, the only logical course of action to remedy the situation is to put your troubles on the bus. We do exactly the same thing in our adult lives. Instead of trying to understand the other person's point of view, we attempt to banish those interactions with others that are challenging to our sense of security. There's just one flaw in this throwaway strategy. I'm going to call it the boomerang effect. You know, during the opening words this morning, I read the poem, "I Don't Like My Boomerang." And the poem concludes with this line, "A boomerang is for life." So are our problems that develop through our interactions with others. We can try to throw away our problems, but they just keep coming back. What should we do in order to relate to another person's worldview? We can start by listening to what others have to say. We start listening when we ask, "What do you think?" And then we follow that up with this question: "Why do you think that way?" It's a valuable skill to know how to listen to another person's point of view. It's also critical for our survival as a species. Dov Seidman, the author of the book How, said this: "When the world is bound together this tightly, everyone's values and behavior matter more than ever because they impact so many more people than ever. We've gone from connected to interconnected to ethically interdependent." Do we really incorporate our 7 principles into our lives? Or when it becomes inconvenient to uphold their potential, do we banish them to the bus to be driven out of sight and out of mind? How do we start to practice our Unitarian Universalist principles in our everyday lives? We start by making an attempt to understand the worlds that others inhabit. It begins when we apply this concept to our thinking. We all coexist on this same planet together. But every one of us lives in a different world. Amen. Our closing words today: take courage, friends. The way is often hard, and the path is never clear. And the stakes are very high. Take courage, for deep down, there is another truth. You are not alone.